Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And yes, Jim, it really is Friday. We got here. Congratulations.
Yay!
And we start with really good news on the economy. This is from Yahoo Finance. The May jobs report is out, and it's a big beat. In May, the U.S. economy created 223,000 new jobs, while the unemployment rate fell to a new post-crisis low of 3.8%, according to the latest release from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This is the lowest unemployment rate since April 2000. If the unemployment rate drops another tenth of a percent, it'll be the lowest since the 1960s. According to estimates from Bloomberg, non-farm payrolls were only expected to grow by 190,000, while the unemployment rate was expected to stay at 3.9%. Wage gains were also better than expected in May, as average hourly earnings rose 0.3% over the prior month. Economists had expected that wages would grow by 0.2%, but many economists have said they'd expect wages to be rising at a faster rate given the level of unemployment. Not to be outdone, the U6, that is what some people call the real unemployment rate because it factors in people who are settling for part-time jobs or have gotten discouraged and don't look for work anymore. That's now at the lowest rate since May of 2001 at 7.6%. The only slightly frustrating number is the labor force participation rate, which is still down at 62.7%. But Jim, anytime your unemployment rate's under 4%, you got to be pretty happy, and it's still getting lower.
I was thinking about you and I have been doing this podcast for how many years now?
Almost eight.
Okay. So when we started, we were still in, if not the depths of the Great Recession, near the trough of the Great Recession. I mean, it was particularly high. I'm sure there were probably some economists who looked at the wrenching changes in the American economy, the shift from full-time to part-time work, helped along by Obamacare and the disincentive for creating 40-hour-a-week jobs. And we kind of wondered if you would ever see a return to 4% unemployment, whether that had ended, that the era of automation, the housing bubble bursting, all the different things that had added to the economic troubles of the end of the Bush years and the beginning of the Obama years, whether they'd become insurmountable. You know, remember the phrase, the new normal. Well, now we know that was not the new normal. It was a long, hard slog. Many folks on the right would argue that adding a Republican House and a Republican Senate helped mitigate the damage of bad Obama economic policies. Democrats, no doubt, would argue against that. However, for everyone who says, oh, Trump is going to destroy the economy, you can't really make that case. I'm still thinking of the prominent liberal writer who announced on election night that because he was so terrified of what Trump was going to do to the economy, he had sold all of his stocks, and then he missed the giant run-up for much of 2017. During the entire following the jobs reports throughout the Obama era, you know, we would argue about whether that U6 was the most accurate, and there was the whole discussion about discouraged workers. If you look on YouTube, there's a video of me using my then small children's toys to demonstrate how they counted it and the argument about discouraged workers. I would think, Greg, looking at your window and seeing a world with 3.8% unemployment rate, that the number of discouraged workers should be pretty darn small, that you should not feel discouraged about your likelihood of finding a good job in this environment. I'd kind of argue if you don't think you're going to get one in this environment, what do you need to see? Because, I mean, you know, obviously different regions will have different unemployment rates, but by and large, this is about as good as it gets. It's great to see the wage going up. And at the, you know, throughout the economic debates of the Obama years, people argue that the declining workforce participation rate was a reflection of the baby boomers retiring and certain other things that were baked in the cake, that they weren't something that a government policy could necessarily address. Well, considering how the unemployment, I'm sorry, the labor force participation rate isn't really taking off the way we would like. And we're not seeing, you know, it kind of goes up a little bit some months, goes down a little bit some other months. I think there's a case to be made that the folks who are out of the workforce right now, voluntarily, it may be may be very difficult to get them back in. If this kind of economic environment doesn't make you want to look for work or change jobs or look for something, it's very unlikely that anything else is going to spur you to do that. So I don't want to say the economy is as good as it possibly can get, but we're probably in that neighborhood. And that is a terrific good martini to end the week with.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. So we can't savor that too long, though, because we have to get to a pretty bitter bad martini, which I guess affects folks like us a little bit more than folks who don't live in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Jim, I know we were very frustrated. We're still pretty frustrated that on the federal level, a Republican House, Republican Senate, and Republican president couldn't get Obamacare repeal done, or at least a major overhaul last year. But if you're looking for a silver lining, at least all those Republicans didn't get together to massively expand the government's role in healthcare. But that's exactly what a lot of Republicans just did in Virginia. For 4 years, Terry McAuliffe, when he was governor, wanted to expand Medicaid. Republicans had a much larger majority in the House of Delegates then and always blocked it. Now it's a narrow 51-49 Republican edge in the House of Delegates, a 21-19 edge in the state Senate. And Governor Ralph Northam, the Democrat, got what he wanted. This is from WTOP, the top radio news station here in Washington. After months of inaction, Virginia's General Assembly passed a budget Wednesday that expands Medicaid to around 300,000 low-income Virginians. Listen to these lopsided votes in the House. The House voted 67-31 Wednesday night to send the two-year budget bill to the governor and 68-30 to send the caboose bill to the governor that the Senate approved earlier that day. Now, in the Senate, the vote was 23-17 to expand Medicaid as part of the state's budget. That means four Republicans ended up crossing over to join all 19 Democrats. Those four Republicans are a guy named Ben Chafin, the Senate Finance Committee co-chair Emmett Hanger, Frank Wagner, who tried to be the Republican nominee for governor last year and was also a big factor in the huge transportation tax hike a few years ago, and Jill Vogel, who promised she was a conservative last year when she was the nominee for Lieutenant Governor Jim. Between her and Bob McDonnell, these regrettable votes we've had in Virginia are really starting to pile up.
You know, Greg, I suppose we could look at this development in the state legislature, and one of the lessons could be elections have consequences. When Democrats win a lot of seats in the state legislature, then the likelihood of enacting a liberal policy priority greatly increases. Also, looking at how Republicans ended up being the deciding votes for this initiative and this expansion of Medicare, we could also say that elections have consequences. If you vote for the conservative Republicans, they will enact liberal priority. Wait a second. What am I saying? That means elections don't have consequences. It means that whoever you vote for, they're going to end up voting for expansion of Medicaid. It would be one thing if these Republicans had voted on saying, you know what, this is one area where I think the Democrats have a point. I've always supported this from when this was, you know, first enacted as part of the Obamacare legislation. That would be one thing. We wouldn't like it. We would argue against it. You probably would have had divisive primary fights about it. But, well, at least you're taking a stand and you're letting the voters see where you are. Now it's like, I oppose expanding Medicare until it gets hard, and then I support it. And that's exactly what we stand against here. That it's kind of infuriating. It's enraging. I think it adds to cynicism about politics. Why should you vote for a conservative Republican if they're going to just kind of fold when push comes to shove and it becomes a difficult vote? I'm used to seeing this from some lawmakers. A couple of those names on that list, particularly Vogel, stand out to me as folks I would not expecting that way, suggesting that, look, either they've really rethought things, or deep down they like the idea of being fiscally conservative and holding the line on spending and not expanding entitlements, and understanding that Medicaid is designed for only a certain, the genuinely poor, and not for an expansion, raising the income levels. But no, never mind. It just got tough, and they decided to buckle. So that's where we are, Greg.
And we're not heartless here. As Jim explained, there's a lot of reasons to be opposed to this, not the least of which is, well, a lot of studies have shown that you don't really get any better care under Medicaid because a lot of doctors won't see you. You have coverage, but you don't have access. You still wind up in the emergency room a lot of the time. And so markets, free markets, competition, driving down prices and attracting customers is the way to go. But now even a decent chunk of Republicans don't even want to actually advocate for that. So way to go, Virginia. Way to go.
All right. Oh, that stings, Greg. That stings.
All right, Jim, let's move on to our crazy martini now. And apparently, crazy comments are pretty much owning the crazy martini this week. It started with Roseanne. Then we were on to both Joy Reid and Samantha Bee. But Samantha Bee got most of the attention yesterday. And yet more from the quote-unquote hacked Joy Reid blog is coming out to prove that either this hacker had a lot of free time, which is probably not the case, or Joy Reid said a lot of really controversial things back in the day, and she's now really regretting it. We've talked in the past couple days here about many of the things that she said in the past. There's three more that have just come out since our last conversation about her, one of which you point out in the Morning Jolt today. This is a blog post from 2006 where she says, this is a little bit long here, "I know it sounds like moonbatty fanaticism, but if you believe that your government would lie, cheat, and attempt to destroy people in order to start a war that doesn't even make strategic sense, but which they had to know would result in the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of people, if you believe that men who are supposed to be working for us are working so much against us that they would give away American industry to foreign powers, permit the breaching of our borders in order to feed slave labor to multinationals, that they would strip Americans of the most basic civil rights and make about 40% of us like it or be too afraid not to. We also found out that back right around the time of the Virginia Tech shooting, she superimposed John McCain's head on the body in a picture of the shooter with a gun in each hand and a bulletproof vest on. And we know what criticism of John McCain normally gets people these days, but apparently not her. And she actually agreed back in 2005 that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, was really onto something when he suggested that the Zionist regime of Israel should just relocate to Europe, saying God is not a real estate broker. He can't just give you land 1,000 years ago that you can come back and claim today. Not even talk about the grammar. Jim, why is this woman still accepted in polite society?
I'm going to take him in reverse order, Greg. The first is, yeah, because it's not like anything bad's ever happened to Jews in Europe, right?
Right.
I also would point out that she—you didn't even get to one of my favorites—was her reference to Wolf Blitzer as an AIPAC flack.
Yes.
I would point out that, you know, I mean, Wolf Blitzer is Jewish. AIPAC is the American-Israeli Political Action Conference. You know, if not overtly anti-Semitism, then starting to drive through the neighborhood of anti-Semitism. Going back to the McCain thing, I think that's probably the single most tasteless and obnoxious and over the top of her recent things discovered on this blog. We don't know whether she created the image or merely shared the image. But again, I mean, this was the sort of thing you get on fringy, you know, like I'm not even sure that stuff would fly at Daily Kos, right? I mean, from perspective on this. And it's a particularly awkward time for it to come out. Oh, by the way, she was, implicitly comparing John McCain to school shooters at a time when, you know, McCain is fighting cancer, not really expected to be with us for that much longer. And, you know, everybody other than maybe, you know, President Trump is feeling pretty good about him and trying to appreciate what he's done for the country throughout his life. The irony is that the controversial or surprising statement that I had found and wrote about in the Morning Jolt, I think it's a little hyperbolic to say that illegal immigration was permitted for slavery for multinationals. This was always one of the objections made by people who wanted a secure border, and whether or not you believed a border wall was the right way to do it. You wanted a secure border and you wanted to end illegal immigration because it's wrong. I'll quote the wise philosopher and Congressman Sonny Bono, who asked for his position on illegal immigration, said, "Well, it's illegal, isn't it? It's against the law. It's immoral. It is obviously a security risk. If migrant workers can sneak across the border, then drug dealers and terrorists and other people with malevolent intentions can get across the border. But also, finally, yes, I think it's very safe to say a lot of illegal immigrants get exploited by their employers. An illegal immigrant will do work that other folks won't, and they also will not go run a file, you know, file a claim with OSHA over unsafe working conditions. They're not going to run to the cops if they're abused. They're not going to, you know, that I don't think it's outrageous to say that it is, you know, that the American economy and certain unscrupulous employers and industries have exploited illegal immigrant labor. I think we can argue about whether we think the slavery comparison is applicable. But what's at heart here is like if she once felt this way. Joy Reid, what changed your mind? When did you stop seeing illegal immigration as a problem? When did border security stop being something you thought was important? And when did it, you know, when did you decide, oh, no, these are just the very best of people who want to live the American dream? Americans in every single way except their papers, as President Obama once famously described them. Some of us would believe that, you know, what it says in your papers matters and can't just be hand-waved away. Now, if Joy Reid had said, you know what, back in the tail end of the Bush administration, early years, the Obama administration, I felt differently about things, fine. Right? You know, people change their minds on everything. I think she's changing her minds in the wrong direction. But, you know, everybody's free and entitled to do this. It's this asinine, oh, I was hacked excuse in which she kind of contends that this nefarious hacker somehow went in and was inserting, because clearly there's some parts of those sections there that she still stands by. I'm sure all the criticism of Bush, et cetera, et cetera. It's just the implicit criticism of open borders and illegal immigration, I'm sure she would claim was behind the work of this nefarious thing. Now, look, it's been a big week for controversial, incendiary statements. We can argue about whether Joy Reid is better or worse than Samantha Bee, who's better or worse than Roseanne Barr. What I can't, I don't think anybody can dispute is that there's a extraordinarily glaring double standard here that I think hinders the ability to really prevent any future incendiary comments. That if you want to see fewer things from the likes of Roseanne Barr, well, then you have to take Samantha Bee's type statements seriously. And you have to take, you know, Joy Reid. She doesn't get to hide behind the, oh, I was hacked, I never said those things, implausible excuse. If you want to have a better and more civil and more constructive public dialogue, you can't enforce the rules for just one side. And, you know, in addition to Joy Reid, I think a lot of this goes on the feed of MSNBC, who has said nothing about this and keeps saying, oh, we're not going to comment until the end of the hacking investigation and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I don't think most other networks would be able to get away with this battening down the hatches and just trying to wait out the storm as long as it takes. I mean, a good question will be, does the rest of the media hold Joy Reid and MSNBC accountable, or do they let the story go away? Because there's so much stuff out there. Right before we came on air, I went and I found a portion where Joy Reid was, you know, mocking a statement by President George W. Bush, describing a plot by Al-Qaeda terrorists. They wanted to hijack a plane by trying to hide explosives in their shoes. Now, never mind, there was that guy in late 2001 who they caught, the Shuna Bomber, as he was nicknamed in some circles. She goes on, this how absurd this is. Would they detonate the bomb before or after they took the cockpit? She just kind of thinks the whole thing is kind of silly. Of course, within 3 years, somebody set off a bomb in their underwear on a flight into Detroit. So again, is this, you know, outrageous and the most ludicrous thing Joy Reid has said? No, it probably doesn't even make the top 50. She's a busy woman. But it does kind of illustrate that she was very much a fringe, out there, incendiary, and I would argue not particularly bright or insightful or thought-provoking or interesting commentator. You could argue about whether she's grown a lot in the past, you know, 10 years or so. I'm not sure the evidence for that is all that glaring, but do lots of other people get picked out of the comment sections on right-wing sites and given their own show on MSNBC? I don't think so, Greg.
Nope, doesn't happen. Wow, what a week. Jim, have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.